Well, we're moving along, and it won't be too long before our summer series is finished. I think August 8th is our last day, so that gives us a few more weeks together, and I'm looking forward to our topic today. I can't figure it out because, you know, I know that I'm innocent of all charges when it comes to this, but my beloved wife suggested that from time to time I might pick on her with an illustration or something like that, and it just rang so hollow, you know, as far as I was concerned. But I will actually talk about something where we disagree in a profound way today, and there are not too many of those areas, so we'll see. if you think about the history of Israel in a brief fashion, the Exodus occurs around 1250. You know, it's very difficult to pinpoint these things exactly, but you know, the evidence points toward around the year 1250 is the time for the Exodus, and that puts the conquest, the entry into the land, at about, say, 1200. And there's a period of time when judges rule. There's actually a pretty interesting find if you go on the Times of Israel website. There are a couple other places you can look. They seem like they have found the name Yeruv Baal, which is the original name for Gideon. So they found that name inscribed. I think it was on a piece of pottery or something like that. And of course, it could have been more than one person with that name, but it's interesting because it's from about the right time period. And the further you go back in Israelite history, the less and less archaeological evidence you have to, you know, having the name Yeruv Baal doesn't actually confirm every detail of the Gideon story, but it lends some credibility to the notion that there's some historicity to what's going on. That period of the judges there, people like Deborah, Samson, Gideon, and so forth, Ehud, that occurs for a couple hundred years, and then the monarchy is a pretty easy date. It's right around the year 1000. And so from where we are today, it's about 3,000 years ago, which was when the monarchy, Saul, David, Solomon, gets going in Israel. We're such a new country. I mean, I remember when I was a boy and we had the bicentennial, and I'm sure, you know, y'all remember that, and the different quarters that they had before they, you know, did like all 50 different quarters and more. I thought that was a really cool thing to do that. I still remember vividly the fireworks displays that they had at the bicentennial. Bicentennial, 200 years. What is this to a place where history goes back 3,000 years? Jerusalem had a celebration in the year 2000. It was their 3,000th anniversary of the founding of the city there. These are times that are very difficult to get your head around. So the monarchy starts about the year 1000, and it doesn't last very long as a monarchy that rules over the entire country. Saul comes in and he unfortunately just does a pretty terrible job at being king. I have a soft spot for Saul, but he still didn't do a great job. David is a terrific king. Now, David's got skeletons. They built closets for David to have skeletons in, so he's got his issues there. But in terms of effective politics, he's really, you know, quite amazing. Solomon is far more powerful than David, but it comes at a cost because he becomes so tyrannical that eventually the northern kingdom just breaks away. Now, they couldn't do it when Solomon was alive, but as soon as he dies, that's when the split happens. And so from that point forward in Israelite history, you're really going to have two different countries. And so the northern part of the land kept the name Israel, and the southern part was named after that big, large tribe that was at the heart of it, Judah. And so you have Israel in the north and Judah in the south. The south is going to last longer than the north does, but there's a reason. It's because the south was no great prize to get. It did have Jerusalem, but Jerusalem's at the very tip top of the south. Everything from there down toward the Negev, it just gets drier and bleaker and dustier and more desert-like with every passing mile as you go south. The reason that they didn't have to conquer the south was because, well, there weren't very many people living there. And there wasn't a whole lot that you were going to get out of the place, even if you did conquer it. It's, of course, my favorite part of Israel. But this is where Michelle and I are in profound disagreement. She likes the north. The north is this beautiful Napa Valley, Sonoma, gorgeous, you know, kind of territory. If you've been to Napa, you've been to northern Israel. I mean, this is what the land is like. There are olive trees and there are grape vineyards that are a year. We only average about 52 or 53, which is, you would never think that this is the case, because it's easy to get into your head the biblical world and think that it's all the, you know, it's everywhere that T.E. Lawrence was, right? It's nothing but sand dunes and, you know, Alec Guinness down there, and I'm actually going to quote from him a little bit later today, but this is not really the case. When you're in northern Israel, this is a place of abundant fertility. It would remind you very much of that area of California where wine country is. Well, there is a problem that attends this tremendous prosperity that happens in the north. It's really two different problems. One of the problems is addressed by Amos. Amos is absolutely incensed that this prosperity that is being enjoyed in the north is being kept away from certain parts of society. And so he's very upset that here in the north you've got all of this prosperity and there are systematic ways that they're cutting some people off from enjoying that prosperity. You know, Amos, I try very hard to stay out of politics when I do anything up here. Amos doesn't talk a whole lot about governmental solutions to this. That's not what he's after. You know, Micah will be the one who's more upset at the government, and what he's upset about is that the elite classes are taking the land away from the middle classes, the people that have land. And so that's what Micah's about. Amos doesn't really focus on that. He focuses on interpersonal relationships, and he's upset about two things. One, he's upset about exploitation. Let's start it the other way. He's upset about corruption that denies the poor justice. And then he's upset about exploitation that denies the poor mercy. And so when it's that issue of corruption, he has lines like this. You make the ephah small. I don't know, what the heck is an ephah? What it was talking about is, let's imagine that we intend to buy a quart of wheat, a shekel grate. Well, I mean, we know what shekels are. Shekels are money. But you got to think of it this way. It was something that you weighed. And so here on the one side, you're putting what's supposed to be a shekel's amount of silver, but you've made your measurement a little bit too heavy. So to get that scale to balance, you're having to put more and more silver on the scale to get it. So now you're getting 9/10 of a gallon of wheat, and you're supposed to be paying a shekel, but you're really paying 1.1 shekels for it. In other words, you're getting taken advantage of on both ends. And then it says, and you're adding in the sweepings of the wheat. In other words, you're not just getting the wheat, but all that chaff and husk and stuff like that, you're sticking a little bit of extra in there too, so you're not even getting the quality that your cheeseburger that is up there. And it doesn't always work out quite that way when you get this smash thing in your bag. So that's maybe you're not getting the quality. And we've all had situations where we were promised this and we got that, or we were overcharged. But come on, it's just part of life. And we just kind of, you know, while we might get upset and we might be willing to take this, just my father, oh man, he is one of those that, you know, he is Amos-like when it goes for going after injustice for himself. When Dish Network overcharges him, I mean, lo, the prophets come forth. You know, he's willing to go after them. Some of you are like that, right? But for most of us, it's not the difference between eating a meal and not eating a meal if that happens to us. But what if you're right at that line of society where you can't make it if you get things turned against you just a little bit? That's what Amos is upset about. So he's upset about this corruption that will not give them justice, and he's upset about exploitation that won't give them mercy. Because see, for people of faith, it's not enough just to give people what they have agreed to. That's what justice is. It's that next step about mercy. It's that when you see a person who's in desperate straits, Don't take advantage of them. Don't give them what they deserve. Give them what they don't deserve, is the idea. And so this is where that spirit among people of faith should be there, to give people generosity, to give them the benefit of the doubt, to round up that tip to that person who isn't as wealthy as you, that kind of thing. It's that element of saying, we're people of faith, God has blessed us, let's pass that along to the next person. That's what Amos focuses on. It's interesting, Amos talks almost nothing at all about religious stuff in terms of like who you're supposed to worship. What he talks about is ethical stuff. And then you get to Hosea. Hosea, also writing to the exact same group of people, those people in the north, he talks almost not at all about ethical issues. What Hosea is upset about is religious fidelity. If you look at Ezekiel, God bless him, Ezekiel's got a screw loose to begin with. But if you look at some of the things Ezekiel has to do, I mean, there's this moment where Ezekiel has to build a miniature Jerusalem and then take toy siege engines and go after it. He's got to lie on one side for 390 days and on the other side for 40 days while he cooks food, God tells him to, over dried human dung. And that's where Ezekiel finally draws the line. He says, I will not do it. This is unclean. I'm not going to do it. All the other things. Okay, I'll do this. And God finally concedes, okay, you can do it over camel dung instead. He says, okay, that's more like it. What does one do when one's minister is playing with toy siege engines, lying on one side and cooking rationed out food over camel dung? This is not a scour the highways and byways and come and join us for the kickoff Sunday for the fall. This is the kind of guy, I'm going to let you do you and I'm going to do me. They do these sign acts all over the place. Isaiah has to walk around for 3 years naked to illustrate the punishment that's going to happen to a certain group of people. You want to say, Lord, wouldn't a half hour on a Sunday afternoon take care of this and we could all be done? It's Hosea's sign act is, Hosea, you need to go and marry a woman who's a prostitute. And then after she's unfaithful to you, as she undoubtedly will be, divorce her. And then at a later time, go back and marry her again. And you go, now what in the world? God, please, this is not fit any definition of what we ought to be doing. This is purely to illustrate God's relationship with Israel. The relationship with Israel that has taken place here is that Israel and God have gotten married. That's what Sinai is all about. We've been through this with Exodus. The Sinai moment is a marriage between God and Israel. And the trouble is, the Israelites have been unfaithful in marital terms. This is the way Hosea puts it. She said, meaning Israel said, I will go after my lovers. They give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink. But she did not know that it was I, God speaking, who gave her the grain, the wine, and the oil, and who lavished upon her silver and gold that they used for Baal. Israel is depicted here as having received all of these favors, and she has attributed them to the wrong paramour. She thinks that all of these blessings, in other words, they put it in real terms, all of the fertility of the north, she thinks that that has come from not God, but from Baal. And so if you put yourself in the divine seat, which is already always a difficult thing to do, but imagine that you're God and you have blessed Israel with all of these wonderful things, and instead of thanking you, she has thanked a different God instead. She's thanking Baal. She's offering sacrifices to Baal. And you can understand why people would be so attracted to Baal. Baal, he's the easiest God. He's the God of the thunderstorm. In other words, he's the God who brings rain. What do you want more if you're a farmer than the God who brings rain? I mean, you're up in the place where they're growing all of these. Nobody worships the God of rain down in the south. It doesn't rain down there. You worship the God of rain up in the north, and Baal's so easy to get along with. Just, there's no legal code associated with Baal. It's just, yeah, give me a sacrifice. I'll give you a bunch of stuff. You give me a little bit of it in return, and we are good. It's My goodness, it's like the most American version of a god you could imagine. You know, this is who Baal is. Well, the problem is that it wasn't Baal who had given Israel all of these blessings. It was the God of Israel. So what is God going to do with Israel? Well, the first thing that he promises is punishment. I will put an end to all her mirth, her festivals, her new moons, her Sabbaths, her appointed festivals. I will lay waste her vines, her fig trees, of which she said, these are my pay, which my lovers have given me. I will make them a forest, and the wild animals shall devour them. I will punish her for the festival days of the Baals, when she offered incense to them and decked herself with her ring and jewelry and went after her lovers and forgot me, says the Lord. It's a pretty tough passage. It's this passage that says, if my fertility is going to be attributed to somebody else, then I will take my fertility away. Because what God says next is, I mean, it's right at the end of chapter 2. He is these children that have been born, you know, metaphorically here after her. And the next response after the punishment is, it's the response of wilderness. I will now, this is verse 14 of chapter 2, I will now allure her and bring her into the wilderness and speak tenderly to her. There she shall respond as in the days of her youth, as at the time when she came out of the land of Egypt. God is depicted on several occasions in the Bible as a hopeless fool. And I don't say that with any bit of disrespect, because that foolishness is directed towards us. It's the story of the prodigal son. It's the son who says, I would rather have the money than you. What you're essentially saying is, I'd be happy if you were dead, because then I'd get the inheritance. And this son goes off and blows the money on wine, women, and song. And he comes back, and as he's making his way back, it says that the father saw the son while he was still a long way off and went running to get the son. What does that mean? It means that the dad who has been, I mean, just imagine it in this culture, this dad who has been so incredibly disrespected is sitting there on the porch just waiting for that son to come around the bend. And then instead of waiting for this son to grovel before him, goes running and scoops up this son and welcomes him with open arms. You know, that's the third of three stories in a row where there's a person who acts foolishly. It's the one about the shepherd with the 99 sheep. Which of you, if he had 100 sheep and one of them walked away, would not leave the 99 and go and look for the one sheep? And as you listen to this, you're supposed to go, oh, Jesus, that's the dumbest thing I've ever heard. No, you wouldn't leave the 99 sheep. What kind of daycare worker are you when your little Johnny walks off and you say, well, you know what the right thing to do is? Just scatter the rest of the kids and go find Johnny. No, you don't do that. And what do they do when they find this sheep? You come in and you call everybody in to celebrate. Over a lost sheep that you found? Come and give me a break. Or there's the second story. It's one of the most misunderstood stories in the Bible. It's the old woman who has lost the coin, right? She's got 10 coins and she's lost a coin. And she's ransacking her house to find the coin. And you'll see people, well, this was a very important coin and it was so valuable. No! It's just a coin. It's just a regular little coin here, because it fits with all three of these stories. It's just a knuckleheaded sheep, a fairly worthless coin, and a useless son. And in all three of these cases, the owner of those things is willing to make a fool of himself to go looking for it, to go looking for the sheep, to go looking for the coin, to wait for that son to come back. Who in the story is who? We're the knuckleheaded sheep and the worthless coin and the useless son. And God is the one who makes a fool of himself to go searching for the sheep and ransacking the couch and waiting for the sun to reappear. God is depicted on a number of occasions as someone who, though he is disrespected again and again and again, just can't leave us alone. And so he comes back. And in this story of Hosea, this is what happens. God foolishly imagines, this time she'll be faithful to me. I'm going to go after her one more time, and this time she'll be faithful. Now, where do they go? Where does God say he's going to take her to rekindle their romance? He's going to take her back to the wilderness, back to the place where they first fell in love. You can almost put it in like real human terms today, right? You can imagine a marriage that's in trouble, and you decide, let's go back to this place where we went on that vacation or we went for that weekend, and maybe we'll be able to sort of rekindle and refine that spark that we want to. It's just so incredibly earthy, isn't it, the way that you read this here. Where is that place where God is going to rekindle his romance? Or if we flip it around the other way, where is this place where Israel will rediscover who she's really supposed to be? It's in the wilderness. It is very difficult to overstate the importance of the wilderness in the Bible. I confess that I have a soft spot for the desert. Michela, as I mentioned, she loves the Galilee. My place is, I love the desert. I love it down in the wilderness. There is this stony, stark kind of beauty that's down there. There's this quiet, these places that is the setting for Psalm 23. You never read Psalm 23 quite the same after you've read it in the bottom of this canyon that is there. The places like En Gedi that are there along the shores of the Dead Sea or Matsada. You know, it's funny, I told you that I was going to quote from Alec Guinness here, and not the Obi-Wan, but the King Faisal version of it. When T.E. Lawrence, at least in the movie Lawrence of Arabia, makes his way to King Faisal, King Faisal says to him, I think you're another, and I can't do it with Alec Guinness's voice, who can? I think you're another of these desert-loving English, Gordon of Khartoum. And then he's got a great line in there. No Arab loves the desert. We love water and green trees. There's nothing in the desert. No one loves nothing. This is his line. Well, Lawrence loved that nothingness that was there. I confess I have a soft spot for those places down in the south. It is difficult to overstate the importance of the wilderness in the Bible. It's not that the Israelites loved the wilderness. Although it comes up repeatedly, it's a tough place. It's a place that has very little water. It has little food. It's a difficult place. I can enjoy the desert because I can carry with me a little bubble of the north. I mean, we've got a car, and we have water, and we have food, and all of these things. I wouldn't love the desert nearly so much if I were Abraham having to sojourn through it and hope that I could find a spring or an oasis. It's just that the desert figures so prominently in the experience of who the Israelites are. It is in the desert, it's in the wilderness, that the Israelites first learn to trust God. It is in the wilderness that they will go back and learn to trust God again. The whole point of the book of Numbers is, will the people learn in the wilderness to trust in God's authority and in God's provision? When you are an Israelite and you lack food in the wilderness, will you trust God to provide and obey the law that's given to him? This is the role that the wilderness plays in the life of Israel. It is in the wilderness. The wilderness is their basic training. They're not going to be God's people if they can't survive this moment in the wilderness where they have to learn to trust him. That is Israel's experience. You know, what's interesting is that it's not just the nation of Israel as a whole that goes through a wilderness experience. When you really trace this out, there are repeated characters who have a wilderness experience in the Bible. For one thing, Moses. I mean, the life of Moses is actually a miniature version of the life of Israel. Moses has to go through his own wilderness experience. Remember, he's enjoying what seems to have been at least a good life in Egypt, but he has to flee. And where does he flee? He flees to Midian. He flees to the wilderness. And where is it that he finally meets God? He doesn't meet God in Egypt. He meets God when he's on what in Hebrew it says, Ahar HaMidbar, on the backside of the wilderness. I'm convinced this is like a southern Israelite, you know, phrase for middle of nowhere, that kind of thing. You know, it's not the end of the earth, but you can see it from there, those kinds of things. He's there in the middle of nowhere. He's in the wilderness. And that's when God finds him and is able to come to terms with him. It's interesting that Moses, too, has to experience that issue of, will you trust me in the wilderness? Isn't that what the call and his objections are all about? The person who is not trusting God in Moses' call, it's not the Israelites. They haven't shown up yet. It's Moses. God is saying to Moses, are you going to trust me? It's not just Moses. Elijah. Elijah has his own wilderness experience. You know the story of his contest with the prophets of Baal. This is the very next chapter after that. Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, so may the gods do to me and more also if I do not make your life the life, that's a tough phrase, of one of them by this time tomorrow. In other words, if you're not at the same underground condition that the prophets of Baal are by this time tomorrow, may the gods curse me. Then he was afraid. He got up and fled for his life, and he came to Beersheba. Beersheba's on the way to the wilderness, which belongs to Judah. He left his servant there, but he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a solitary broom tree. He asked that he might die. It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my ancestors. He lay down under the broom tree and fell asleep. And you know what happens. An angel comes and ministers to him. And after that angel has ministered to him, it says, he got up and ate and drank. Then he went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb. Horeb is the other name for Sinai, the mountain of God. The life of Elijah is almost identical to the life of Moses. They both spend their 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness. And when I use the phrase 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness, your mind can't help but think of that other person ministered to by God. It wasn't just Jesus. David had to hide out in the wilderness. David actually has two wilderness times. There is this one wilderness moment where he's down in En Gedi, which is power. He's the king, and eventually his son Absalom comes. He takes over, and David has to escape. And where does he escape to? He escapes into the wilderness one more time. A lesser known figure, Paul. Paul had his own wilderness experience. In Galatians 1, he says, when God, who had set me apart before I was born, called me through his grace and was pleased to reveal his son to me so that I might proclaim him to the Gentiles, I did not confer with any human being. I didn't go up to Jerusalem to those who were already apostles before me. I went away at once into Arabia. And afterwards, I returned to Damascus. When Paul is called to be God's servant, what is the first thing he does? He goes into the wilderness. Jesus is tempted in the wilderness. But you know, that's not Jesus's only wilderness moments, is it? Matthew 14, now when Jesus heard this, he withdrew from there in a boat to a deserted place by himself. Now what's terrible about the life of Jesus is he can't find time by himself. So he gets in the boat and tries to go to a deserted place. And what happens? When the crowds heard it, they followed him on foot from the towns. And so here he tried to get away, and it only resulted in the 5,000 being among him or around him. He fed them, and once he dismissed them, he made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he dismissed the crowds, he went up to the mountain by himself to pray. Normally, a wilderness experience is something that is inflicted upon you. The Israelites didn't choose the wilderness to go there. Had they had their, you know, their choice, they would have immediately walked out of Egypt and into the Promised Land. That the sea they crossed and the Jordan would have been the same body of water, and this whole trip would have not included the wilderness as part of it. Normally, characters like David hiding, like Elijah fleeing, like David hiding again, they don't choose to go to the wilderness. The wilderness is something that happens to them. You know, we use the phrase a wilderness period when we talk about people. Think about Churchill. He'll have his period in the wilderness, right? From after World War I, where Gallipoli went so terribly, until that time at World War II, where finally his wilderness period is over and he comes back into power. The wilderness is not something that you normally choose. Isn't it interesting that Jesus seems to recognize that there are times when the wilderness is the thing that you should choose? Jesus chooses to go to a deserted place. Jesus chooses to go to the mountain by himself, and the most awful wilderness experience in all of Scripture happens not in the wilderness, but in a garden. It's in Gethsemane that Jesus chooses a wilderness experience, because he leaves the disciples behind, he takes a few for support and then leaves them behind, and then goes over a stone's throw away to be by himself. What Jesus is choosing is another wilderness moment, a place where he can be alone with God. One of the things that is so important about the wilderness is that it clears away clutter and gives us the opportunity to finally be alone with God. We have talked about many different ways for finding God through this series. We have talked about how important the seeking is, how important the search is, and we've talked about all different sorts of ways that we can try to seek God. We've talked about seeking God in nature. We've talked about seeking God in our fellow human beings. We've talked about seeking God in worship. One of the ways that we are called to seek God is to seek God in silence. To seek God is, they don't really put it this way exactly in Scripture. They don't say to seek God in silence. What they say is to seek God in the wilderness. To seek God in those places where we can be alone. Jesus carves out times to be alone with God so he can seek the face of God. Let me give you three ideas, three lessons maybe, about how we can seek God in silence. The first of these is this: if we truly want to see God, part of our search, at least, will have to be alone. If we want to seek God, part of our search, at least, will have to be alone. We can do a lot when it comes to seeking God in the company of others. This is what you're doing this morning. We can do a lot in church. We can do a lot with others. Others can help us along. They can keep us accountable. They can repeat to us those things that we know are true. There are a lot of things that we can do by ourselves. If we never seek God by ourselves, there's a decent chance that we may not actually be seeking God at all. Church fulfills a need in us. It surely does. It fulfills a social need. It fulfills a need for companionship and encouragement and purpose and beauty. I mean, God made us to worship. And so to be here together worshiping is a perfectly normal thing. I think we're reflecting part of who God made us to be when we do this. But if church is all that we do, it may be that what we're seeking is church. It may be that what we're seeking is the companionship that we get out of church. It may be that we're seeking the beauty that we get out of church. It may not be that we're seeking the God who is the very point of church. If we intend to seek God and not just church, God and not just religion, God, part of that search is going to have to be alone. You can't do it entirely with other people. You're going to have to do it, at least in part, by yourself. This is the lesson of Moses and Israel and Elijah. And Paul and Christ. You're going to have to do part of it by yourself. Secondly, you will never hear a more true statement from me than what I'm about to say. There has never been a time when it is more difficult to be alone. There has never been a time in human history when it is more difficult to be alone. I have trekked through just this past month beaches and forests and Muir Woods and Redwood and Crater Lake and Olympic, and even if I do not count my lovely and talented companion who was there with me the entire time, it was difficult for even the two of us to ever be alone in these majestic cathedrals that were there. What must it have been like to be John Muir and have the Yosemite to yourself? There is no such experience available for us today. We have driven countless miles in the vast expanses of Yellowstone, and we were never by ourselves. There were always other people who were there. To be alone in Yosemite, they actually have this elaborate system of wilderness permits that you have to apply for. It's like trying to get one of the golden tickets, you know, from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It's very difficult to get one of these. We wanted one time, and so my father, my brother, and myself were in three separate locations, ready, watching the Navy clock, honest to goodness, so that we could press the button and get the wilderness permits that we wanted at the same time. This is the only way that they're allowed to let just this trickle of people in, and it works. So that you only see three or four different groups of people a day. But even then, there are planes overhead, and there is cell service. Have you ever noticed, it's one of the things I was watching with one of my sons, the Friends series. When it came out in real time, I didn't watch it. I seem incapable of ever watching TV in real time unless it's sports or something. I was watching through them, and it was fascinating to watch the technological change of the telephone. Because early in the series, people are finding payphones. And they're calling on phones that are connected by curly cords to the walls and so forth. There's an episode where Chandler skips out on the day of his wedding and they can't find him. And so they're leaving messages on his phone and they're talking about calling this place or that place. You don't do that anymore. You call this person or that person because they carry around with them this device, which is both glorious and a curse, all at the same time. It is very difficult to be alone now because we are constantly surrounded by other people in a crowded world and by technological devices that bring literally the entire world into our pockets 24 hours a day. To be alone with God will require setting aside phone and tablet and laptop and television and radio and perhaps even that soft music that's playing in the background to truly be alone with God. One of the reasons that Israel could hear God better in the wilderness is because there's no one there. It's hard to go to a place where it could just be you and your Creator alone. You just about had to do it in the south, in the wilderness, in the desert. When Elijah was down at Sinai, that it was splitting mountains and breaking rocks in pieces before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake. But the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire. But the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a sound of sheer silence. And that was where Elijah found God. It was when all even of this natural noise had passed away, and there was that sound of sheer silence. That was where Elijah found God. Thirdly and lastly, if we seek God in silence, we should be prepared to struggle. The time in the wilderness is almost always a time of testing and trial. It's not an easy time, those times of silence. Our times alone with God can actually be some of our most desperate times. You owe it to yourself to take a look at Mother Teresa's journals. Her public face was a face of joy and energy and vivaciousness. Her public face with the people that she served was one of giving and serving and helping. In her private life with God, it was a very dark time. Crying out for God's presence and not finding, but holding on in hope that she would. Sometimes our times alone with God can be our most desperate. The most desperate psalms in the Psalter are the psalms that use the pronoun I. They are those individual psalms where a person and that person's God are struggling to find one another. Our alone times can reveal to us who we really are, why we are really searching. And if we do encounter God, we can be overwhelmed by His presence. Like characters in the Bible, a vision of who God truly is can be comforting, but it can also be terrifying. Time alone, time in silence, can strip away what is extraneous and leave us exposed in the presence of God. Is there anything that, as people of faith, we want more than the beatific vision? I don't know what heaven is really like. Most of the descriptions in the Bible of what heaven is like are just awful. I mean, some of you are choir people, and so an eternity of choir practice maybe sounds great to y'all. As a non-musical person, it just sounds awful to me. An eternity of church is not really what I'm looking for, but I think that really that's not what the description of heaven really is. To be in heaven is to see God. It's the beatific vision. This is what the real blessing is. And yet, is there anything more intimidating than the thought not just of seeing God, but being seen by God? I apologize. Like Jesus Himself, we live in a crowded world. What we need more of, among many things, are some wilderness experiences. May those wilderness experiences not be those imposed wilderness experiences where we are struggling all along the way, but maybe instead some of those self-imposed wilderness experiences where we seek time alone and try to find times of silence so that we can seek after God Himself. Let's pray. Father in heaven, Lord, I thank You for the record of those saints who have gone before us. I thank You for their examples in the wilderness. I pray that You would give us those times in the wilderness that are pleasant times of seeking You rather than those great difficult times of frustration. Lord, help us to find the moments of silence we need to find You. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.